Greetings to everyone, and welcome to the teleclass, Who's Afraid of the CIC Exam? I've been really looking forward to this teleclass topic. My name is Paul Weber, and it's really exciting to have such a large audience registered for this teleclass. Several thousand people and from places all around the globe. That certainly speaks to the importance of the CIC designation, and welcome to all of you. This is, in fact, the third in a series of teleclasses that feature the Certification Board of Infection Control and the CIC exam. If you missed the first two, I'll tell you at the end of this teleclass how to get free access to the recordings and handout notes from those two others. Today, I am pleased to welcome two wonderful people to speak to this topic. Aside from her work with CBIC as test committee chair and with a multitude of other committees and organizations, Sharon Christofiak is also a member of the North American Teleclass Organizing Group. The teleclass education program that you're joining right now is operated on a not-for-profit basis and is organized and run entirely by groups of wonderful volunteers around the world. To all of them and to Sharon, I will say that I am very grateful indeed. Sharon will be joining us in a minute. But to lead off this teleclass is Sheila McDonald. Sheila is the CBIC president this year. She is the first ever Canadian president of CBIC. She is a past president of CHICA Canada, and I know her to be an extremely gracious and very, very well-organized person. So to launch us off on the teleclass, Who's Afraid of the CIC Exam? From Halifax, Nova Scotia, it's an honor to present Sheila McDonald. Sheila.
Thank you very much, Paul. Sharon and I would like to thank you for this opportunity to talk about the certification exam. And I'd also like to extend a very warm welcome to everyone who has listened in this afternoon and is participating in our teleclass today. Sharon and I are a little overwhelmed at the number of people who are participating. But basically today our aim is to provide you with some meaningful and useful information, and also to help maybe allay some of those fears that you may have about taking the certification examination. We got a lot of questions about it, and we know that there's a little bit of angst around it for a number of people. So hopefully we will be able to answer your questions and to put your fears to rest. In terms of discussion points this afternoon, I am going to be starting off, and I'm going to give you a little bit of a background on the certification board, and I'm also going to talk about how we actually construct and build the certification exam. What is our starting point? How do we do this? So that you'll have some understanding of the process that we use. And then Sharon is going to follow that with some more in-depth discussion. She's going to talk a little bit more about the exam itself, the types that are available. She'll talk a little bit about what the test committee does, as well as talking about some of the questions that infection control professionals have posed to the certification board. So hopefully we're going to give you some useful and very meaningful information this afternoon. So to start off, I'm going to talk a little bit about our organization, the Certification Board of Infection Control and Epidemiology. First of all, I want to clear something up. We get this a lot. People sometimes confuse us. They think that we're a part of APIC or that we're an extension of APIC, or some people think we're the same organization. The two organizations, CIBIC and APIC, are completely separate. We certainly work alongside APIC, as we do with CHICA and other organizations. We work collaboratively with APIC, but the two organizations are completely independent organizations. CIBIC is independent and separate from any other infection control related organization or association. The certification board is a voluntary board. We're volunteers. It's, as I said, it's independent, it's autonomous, and we're also a multidisciplinary board, as you will see in a moment in one of my other slides. Our main purpose in life is to develop, and to administer the certification examination process for infection control professionals. That's in essence why we exist. Next slide. Our board members have a very broad range of infection control and prevention and control experience, as you will see. The organization itself is governed by specific bylaws. We also have a number of working committees that actually carry on the business of the organization. Test committee is one of those, and it's a very prominent committee and a very important committee. Next slide, please. We're also, the certification program is also accredited by something called NCCA, or the National Commission for Certifying Agencies. And you might say, well, what is that? What difference does that make? You know, so what sort of thing? Basically, our accreditation with NCCA signifies that our organization, the CIBIC, has met the highest national voluntary standards for private certification. So we are, we strive for the best in producing our examination for infection control professionals, and that certification tells the professional that we are well qualified and we are credible. Next slide, please. Now, a little bit about our board of directors. If you're wondering what our composition is, we have anywhere from 13 to 14 directors, and our bylaws stipulate that we have to have certain expertise on the board. We require at least one medical doctor. I shouldn't say at least, we have one medical doctor, a medical technologist or a medical microbiologist with a Bachelor of Science degree. We need an individual with a master's or a higher degree in education, a master's or a PhD. We need four registered nurses. One of the directors is always a Canadian to represent the Canadian interests. We need an ICP from a non-acute care setting, such as schools, public health, something of that nature. We need an infection control practitioner from long-term care, and we also have a layperson on our board, a non-medical or clinical person, to represent the consumer of healthcare. So all our board members must be certified, with the exception, of course, of our consumer director. Next slide. So CIBIC's mission is to develop the certification process, and it's designed to measure basic knowledge of infection prevention and control. And by doing so, we're trying to improve the quality of healthcare and also increase the number of professionals with our certification exam, who have achieved our certification exam. Next slide, please. Okay, let's talk a little bit about certification and recertification. There are no doubt many of you in the audience today who have achieved your certification, and some of you who are ready to recertify, and probably quite a number of you who are thinking about writing your exam for the very first time. So let's talk a little bit about certification. Let's say that you've written your exam. Let's say you achieved your certification in 1985 or 1990. Okay. Do you think that is enough to carry you throughout your career? Is that one-time demonstration of passing the test and demonstrating your competence, is that one-time demonstration enough to carry you through an entire career in infection control? And as we know, many of us stay in the field for many years because we love it. But let's think about that. Our practice does change, and basically we want to ensure that we have competent infection control people, competent in their knowledge. They know what they're doing, and healthcare consumers expect competent practitioners as well. Next slide, please. Now, basically, CIBIC feels, our philosophy is that competence and demonstrating that competence is not a one-time effort. It's a process that requires repeat measurement, and we do that through our certification exam. And CIBIC's requirement is that if you're going to use the CIC designation, you must write your exam and be successful every 5 years. The certification board does not believe that continuing education is enough. We believe that you need to demonstrate that competence on a regular and on a frequent basis. Next slide, please. Our license, many of us in the audience today are registered nurses. Some are medical technologists, but the majority of us are probably registered nurses. Our license assures minimal competence. We're allowed to practice. We're permitted to practice in our field because we have passed our basic examination. We're competent to practice in our field. However, certification indicates something a little bit beyond that. Our exam indicates mastery of a defined body of knowledge, and that's how competency is measured in infection control. So how do we measure that competency? Well, as I said, through an examination that measures the skills and abilities that would be expected of an infection control practitioner. Next slide, please. And we do that. Our exam is definitely job-related, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a few moments. But it's job-related, and it consists of 150 multiple-choice questions, as many of you know. So how do we derive that exam? Where does it come from? Where do we start? How do we decide what to question people about? How do we decide what needs to be assessed in the practice of infection control? The exam is developed from something called a practice analysis survey, and many of you may have filled that out, and it's distributed currently to infection control professionals in the U.S. and Canada, and also in Saudi Arabia. We have infection control professionals who have written our exams around the world, but by far the largest portion of those people reside in North America, and we have a fairly large contingent in Saudi Arabia as well. Next slide, please. Okay. Now, the first step, how do we build that examination? First step is to do something called a practice analysis survey. Okay, so what is that? Well, some of you have filled it out, so you're going to get a little more information about it. We don't simply sit around a table and develop questions, put them in an exam format, and send them out to people. It's a fairly lengthy and involved process that we use to develop, administer, and analyze the examination and so on. And our very first step is the practice analysis. And basically, what that is finding out what infection control practitioners do, what are our core activities, core practices, what are the most significant things we do in our practice, and what are the most important things that we do? What is required in order to practice safely and competently? So the practice analysis is a way of gathering that information. It's collecting the information about our behaviors and activities in our particular realm, in our job, as infection control practitioners, for the purpose of defining what we put on the exam and also for validating the content of the exam. Next slide, please. Okay, practice analysis, as I said, will describe the core functions, what we do in life as practitioners, and it also helps us assess what should be on the certification exam. And the practice analysis is also necessary for a legally defensible certification program. We do the practice analysis once every 5 years. And the reason for that is that our examination must reflect current practice. And if you just think about what has happened in the infection control world over the past 5 to 6 years, you can understand why we do this every 5 years. If we did a practice analysis, for example, as I've said, in 1991, would that PA reflect current practice today? Well, the answer is no. When you think about our last 5 years with respiratory illnesses of unknown origin, SARS, the threat of pandemic flu. We're now looking at biological terrorism agents, that kind of thing. Even in 1985 to 1989, we probably wouldn't have dreamed of those things at that time. So our practice does change. Next slide, please. Okay. In developing our exam, we partner with a professional testing agency. And again, many of you are familiar with Applied Measurement Professionals. That is the testing agency that CIBIC has a contract with, or AMP for short. And although the certification board provides the content expertise, the infection control content expertise, we very much depend on AMP for their expertise and what they bring to the table. We partner with them because we really need their guidance. They're the experts in analysis, in proper exam construction, in making sure that our exams are valid and reliable, and so on. We really need their expertise in that particular realm. And AMP provides that. So we work in concert with AMP in just about everything we do related to our examination, the development, the administration, the statistical analysis, and so on. So we work hand in hand with the professional testing agency. Okay, now a little bit more about the practice analysis. What goes into this? Well, a committee, an advisory committee is struck. It's a 12-member committee, and it isn't just the certification board itself. That is not the sum total of the committee. It's a panel of experts. We do have, we certainly do have infection control practitioners from the board on the committee. One of our board members chairs the committee. Next slide, please. And we will have some of our board members on the practice advisory committee. Obviously, we're going to have people who are on the test committee, which is the essence of what we do. We have people with very diverse educational backgrounds on our board and also people on our committee. We have people from various work settings, regions, locations, and so on. For instance, we have somebody from Canada on that TA committee. We have other certified individuals, and people who are on that committee must be certified. And, of course, as I mentioned, our AMP psychometrician will be heavily involved in that as well. Next slide, please. So the committee uses previous practice analyses. They use core educational infection control programs and so on to develop and to determine what our core practices are. And they develop the survey. It's emailed to practicing infection control practitioners, as I mentioned before, primarily in North America, but also in Saudi Arabia. And we did email it to quite a number, and we'll see that in a subsequent slide. In terms of the tasks that are on that survey, the one thing that we want people to look at when they're looking at the tasks, we want them to focus in on both the importance and the frequency of that task in their practice. In other words, how significant is this in my day-to-day practice, in the trenches, down on the ground? How important is this? And our scale goes from 0 to 4. 0 is not necessary for the job, 4 being extremely significant. Next slide, please. So we email them out. The survey comes back, and it's reviewed by the advisory committee. It's statistically analyzed, and all our tasks are grouped into content areas. And depending on the weight, depending on how significant those tasks are, depends on where it's placed and also the weight it receives on the examination itself. And the result is a content outline, groups of activities and tasks that we would do as infection control practitioners. That forms the basis of our exam. And this next slide is the classification of the core tasks. And again, this is not new information to many of you. You have seen this before. But these are the core areas in which we work on a day-to-day basis. Everything from identifying infectious disease processes, preventing and controlling transmission, education, management, etc. You're also quite familiar with these. Next slide, please. The practice analysis was completed in late 2005. It was emailed out and analyzed in 2006. The last one was mailed to 9,500 infection control practitioners, and our response rate was about 22%. Not particularly high, but average. We would have liked to have had more, for sure. So the next time we do this, I'm going to get a little plug in here. If you are still in infection control, we would really appreciate it if you would fill out this survey, because based on your responses are going to tell us what is important in our role as infection control practitioners, and that's what we're going to base the exam on. So the new content outline is developed from the responses based on the survey results. Next slide, please. Now, the next few slides are just going to give you a little snapshot, a little summary of the responses that we got. And this is very, very broad, folks. This is not drilled down to finite detail here. Over 60% of our infection control practitioners had 7 or more years' experience. So people stay in the job for a considerable length of time. Almost 50% work in community-based acute care facilities, and greater than 75% of our survey respondents came from facilities with over 100 beds. Next slide, please. 60% had one full-time infection control practitioner. Approximately 52% worked 40 or more hours per week. And of our survey respondents, 53%, a little over half, were certified. So the survey was developed. The survey was sent out to the infection control practitioners. Those 22% who filled it in, it came back to us, and it was analyzed by the committee and by our AMP folks, our testing agency. And the number of tasks were looked at very, very closely, and there were some changes made. I wouldn't say that the changes were terribly dramatic, but there definitely were some changes made because, as I said, our practice has changed over the past 5 years. Some things were deleted, some things were added on that weren't there 5 years ago when we did the last practice analysis. And remember the scale. Not important was zero. Very significant in my job was number 4. Okay. So one thing that we did remove was, one task we removed was contributing to the development of surveillance systems for non-infectious adverse events. This is just an example. Because most ICPs that responded were telling us that we don't do this in our jobs, okay? We do not develop systems for adverse events other than infectious events. Next slide. We did add some things. For example, we added a task statement that says contributes to the development of systems for syndromic surveillance. That is now in our realm for sure. And also we added collaborates with public health agencies in planning community responses to biological agents, for example, anthrax. Again, our lives have changed in the past 5 years. Next slide, please. Okay. We did some revision, and again, of the core groupings, we changed wording a little bit. As I said, nothing terribly extensive, but for example, we changed employee occupational health to read infection control aspects of employee health. Next slide, please. So our revised examination content outline looks like this. There are six categories. And not terribly, terribly different from the previous one, but certainly there are some tasks that have been added and some tasks that have been removed. And this is the outline on which the examinations will be based for the next 5 years. Next slide, please. Okay. Now, after that, we had to take all the questions in the question banks and review every single one of them and reclassify them as necessary to make sure that they actually fit in under the category, the content category, that they should be in. So we had to check that very, very carefully. And if questions no longer fit, they were deleted from the bank. If they were irrelevant or we don't do that anymore, they were deleted. And one other interesting thing was that that the PA showed was that most ICPs who are in the job 2 or 3 years and ICPs who are in the job for 7 years or more, their tasks are basically the same. There's not a great deal of difference between the two-year professional, infection control professional, and the professional at 7 years. What they do is very similar. Now, you can find out more about the content outline. It's in the CIBIC Candidate Handbook, which is available on our website, on the CIBIC website. It will answer a lot of your questions. The new outline is in that handbook, and it's also available on our website as well. If you're thinking about writing the exam, kudos to you. I applaud you for that. Look at the handbook. Read it carefully. Read it carefully, especially if you're an international candidate. The process is a little bit different. So read the handbook carefully, and it will likely answer many of the questions that you have. So next slide, please. That is, for now, that's it for me. And I'm going to hand it over to Sharon now. Sharon Christofiak is our very well-respected chair of the test committee. She does not have an easy job. she does a great job, and she's very well respected, and she's probably going to be answering a lot of the questions that you have in your head right about now. So I'm going to pass it on to Sharon, and I will be back a little later on. Okay, Sharon.
Thanks, Sheila. I think the one thing that I want to remind everybody at this point is that we are actually practicing infection control people. If you're on the CIBIC board, it's a 3-year term. We can up for a second time if you're up for the extra fun, extra hard work for another 3 years. But because we are members of the same communities, the same chapters that you all belong to, we've heard the same comments. We've made the same comments. I hated that question. That was stupid. So we know what the problems have traditionally been and what everybody's fears are, why they haven't taken them. And I'm constantly being asked by members of my own chapter, you know, like, do you think I'm ready to take the exam? So next slide. First, I want to go through some of the general reassurances. We would ideally like everybody who sits for our exam to be able to successfully pass the exam. I think it would do, you know, great honor to the profession to be able to market to the community of healthcare consumers out there that we are all very talented, we can, you know, show that we're competent. There is no intention to create trick questions. That would not benefit the profession or anybody, you know, out there whatsoever trying to pass it. So we really try very hard to make sure that it's a fair exam. You know, we've all had issues where I've missed the word accept, you know, in big words, or not. We've all hated those questions that had multiple choice answers, 1 and 2, 1, 2, and 3. So we've tried very hard to make it much more simplified. We want to measure your competency. It has nothing to do with, you know, trying to come up with a certain percent of people that won't pass. That's one of the reasons we do have a practice requirement. And some of the following slides go through it in more detail. And there's also a training requirement. We feel because we value the profession that it should be something that the average person that's just starting the job can't pass the exam within a week. So essentially, it's something that really says something about the individual. If you've got the CIC credential, it says that you're experienced, you have X amount of practice, you have been trained. You're coming to the party with something really special. You're certified. Next slide. We have a very formal, fancy value statement. And I don't intend to go over it with you, but just to let you know that we really are focused now much more on the customer. I think those of us in the United States are probably very familiar with all the parameters of public reporting. And unfortunately, coming from Pennsylvania, the first state of, you know, what not to do for public reporting, we know how much focus has been brought forward lately about providing quality care. There is a lot of information out there. And, you know, we value this. It's something that only makes our profession stronger. So we do have values. We accept change and we support excellence. Next slide. We also have a very strong philosophy on certification. We think that if you've got that certificate, that you say you have passed this multifactorial exam, you can be in any one of the areas that we all come from. It could be emergency management. It could be long-term care. It could be the neonatal ICU that you're taking care of. It's the infection control person. Because you just never know where you may want to go next week. Next slide. So we do, as I said, have education and practice requirements. And this comes from the Canada's handbook. You have to have either a current license as an RN or registration as a medical technologist, CLS, clinical laboratory scientist. We do have a certain number of physicians that are certified currently. You basically have to have a minimum of a baccalaureate degree or be a registered nurse or have some kind of a credential. We don't necessarily, you know, want people to spend the money to sit for the exam if we don't think that you're going to be able to pass it. So that's one of the reasons that we try and have some type of a standard. We also think that all candidates who take the certification exam should have some type of time invested in the practice. So it's a minimum of 800 hours worked. You don't have to be full-time. You can be part-time. But it's something that we think also adds validity to the credential, that not only are we able to pass the exam, but we've been actually working in the field for a while before we were able to actually sit for the certification exam. And the practice requirements listed have to be met just for your initial or lab certification. If you're already certified and you're not necessarily in the field anymore, you're still eligible to sit for the SARE exam, any of the recertification. You can also take our computer-based test for recertification. So we do have quite a few people that have retired but still keep their hand in it. They're not currently working, but they're still certified, and we really appreciate them. Next slide. Definition of infection control practice. And this, again, is also from the candidate handbook. And, again, you can refer to these later on at your leisure. But the most important are the first two. You have to be able to analyze and interpret the type of data that we all look at for infection control. And we also do investigation and surveillance. The wording of suspected outbreaks may be a little overwhelming. I think of it as even a cluster. If you're coming from a small facility, two of any particular bacteria from a certain unit may be what you would term an outbreak. So it's something to be able to at least pick up that there's something unusual. And I think once we're in the field, we all kind of get to appreciate exactly what we do as infection control professionals. And then you have to do at least three of the following bullet points. Something like planning, implementation, evaluation of measures. We all do this on a daily basis. It's things that we're doing to evaluate. Have our rates gone up? Should we be looking at different products? Education of individuals about infection risk prevention and control. Again, something most of us probably do every day, whether you think about it in a formal sense or it's something you're stopped while you're on your rounds and somebody asks, you know, is this safe to have this patient with this? Do you know anything about this disease? One of my staff members is pregnant. Is she allowed to take care of the person who's got herpes zoster? Anything like this. And we do most of these things on a daily basis without thinking of them, but it's part of our profession and what defines us. Next slide. So the initial exam, we call it affectionately the CBT, computer-based exam. This is the one test that you have to use for your initial certification. However, if you're already certified and you like taking this type of a computer-based test, you're able to recertify every 5 years using this instead of the SARE, which is, of course, our take-home exam. Open book, you've got months to take it, but you may not really want to invest that time. So you're more than welcome to take the computer-based test again and again to keep up your certification. The CBT cost is $310 U.S. for the initial certification. If you're using it for recertification, it's $275. And I know a lot of my chapter members have asked, what is the money for? And as Sheila had alluded, because we have to deal with a professional agency to administer the exam and make sure that everything is statistically right, a lot of this funding does go to make sure that the exam is provided and, you know, distributed through acceptable facilities so that you can take it. We administer it right now at about 140 assessment centers throughout the United States. It's primarily H&R Block tax preparation centers, but there are others, and there's at least 10 centers in Canada right now operating. The sites are listed on the AMP website, GoAMP, and also there's a link from our civic.org website. So if you want to see what's closest to you, you can go by your zip code, your area, look at maps, etc. The nice thing about the CBT, which wasn't available when I first took the exam, you can schedule the date and time. In the old days when we had the pen and paper exam, you had to go on that particular date at that time. This is scheduled around your convenience, so it hopefully is making it much easier for people to be able to sit for the exam. You will have to show identification when you get there. Again, this is part of our NCCA certification, that we have to make sure that as we colloquially call it, a ringer doesn't go in to take the exam for you, that it's really you that have signed up for it and that you're monitored throughout the exam. In the United States test sites, you'll get an instant score when you complete the exam and hit the magic button. You'll know if you passed it or not. We're working on getting this implemented throughout the rest of the world, but right now we're still just U.S. immediate scoring. Next slide. Validity of the exams. If you've ever written any kind of an exam, you probably know that sometimes you've wondered what the professor was going for. Is this a valid test? Since our exams are developed with the guidance of the AMP folks, they have experience with numerous healthcare and other groups, so they are very familiar with what has to be part of the exam. So they make sure that our exams are valid, delivered, and scored. Each item goes through content expert, which would be those of us, the ICPs, and also statistical scrutiny before each use. Before we can use an exam question, we actually pre-test it to make sure that it's, you know, not something that's tricky if we find anything wrong with it. It never goes on as a scored item. The passing scores are calculated to make sure that there's a certain number of hard questions, some easier questions, and because we come out with different exams in different years, we have to make sure that this is all accountable, that if you took it in 2003, it wasn't a harder test than if you took it in 2004. One of the nice things for the United States folks is that the Joint Commission, if you're looking at the infection control standards, they actually mention the CIC exam in there. It's an effective infection control program. So it's something that may help you with your survey. Next slide. Breakdown of the test questions. We look at each section of the content outline, and because of your answers on how important it was in your practice, each section may have a different number of questions, and they'll vary in difficulty and general easiness. But it's based, again, all on the practice analysis. The other big thing, sometimes we would love to come up with a question, very relevant, really important into what we're doing currently. But if we can't find a reference in a text, we can't use the question. And we have a reference list in the handbook that tells you things that are approved. We don't want to make it obscure books. We want it to be things that people have easily at their fingertips. The APIC text is our primary reference right now, and we're in the process of revising that reference list. We know we've given a lot of books there, but sometimes we don't use some of them frequently. We don't want people to think that they need to go out and purchase all these textbooks in order to be able to pass the exam. So we are really working very hard to kind of cut it down so that if you've got a couple of core reference materials to learn from, you should be able to have enough educational material so that you can get prepared for the exam. Next slide. All the questions are analyzed by the AMP people. whenever we complete a test committee meeting, they have all of the information there on previous exams, how well people did on the exam. And they're also very strict with us on making sure that we're using the right type of wording, appropriate wording, not slang. And I know all of you can appreciate, whenever you have a group of infection control people together, we tend to have our own language. We will talk about things like CLABs or COWDIES or VAPS, and it's not something everybody throughout the world may use that colloquialism. So the one that comes to mind frequently is, we'll say a patient is on the ventilator. Well, that's not technically correct, and our AMP guidance people will tell us, no, they are being ventilated. So that the use of English throughout the rest of the world is pretty much standardized. So we really look very carefully at the wording that we use. We also have to see how many candidates get each question correct. If a significant number are getting the question wrong, picking another answer, we have to go back and relook at that question because there may be something wrong with the question. We also try very hard to make sure that all possible answers are plausible. I know we've all taken exams where there was always that one question, you know, or one answer, A, B, C, or D, that you knew was stupid and wasn't even, you know, answering the same kind of a scenario. We try very hard not to do that. We want this test to discriminate between somebody who deserves the credential and not. We don't want to make it too easy, but we don't want to make it too difficult. We also look to make sure that the high-scoring candidates, the people that have been in the field for a long time, that basically, you know everything without having to look it up. If they get a question wrong, something might have changed that we weren't aware of, and we recently had an experience with that, although we knew about it. Sometimes standards change, and then the question's no longer relevant. It may be between when we brought out the exam at the beginning of the year and in June something changes. So if something like that happens, we may have to pull the question off the exam. Next slide. So after we've been beaten up for a couple of days working on this exam, the AMP people will put everything together, come up with impressive statistics for each question, and this way we're able to come out with an exam that is similar to previous years, slightly different, but based on that same content outline. Next slide. So all questions on the exam are based on what's known as cognitive learning principles. There are three domains you're probably familiar with. Affective would be values and feelings. Psychomotor would be something you might do more in the laboratory or the nursing situation where you actually give a medication or injection things. So cognitive is something that we can test on a computer-based exam or any kind of a paper and pencil exam like this AIR. There's three basic levels of questions, and recall is the easier questions. That's something you can complete the sentence without ever seeing the options. This could be something like, who was the first president of the United States? You didn't have to look to see what the answer options were. It's something that will always be answered the same way. Application questions are a little bit more difficult. You have to apply what you know of a subject to select the correct answer. And this could vary on the situation we throw at you. Analysis is the highest level of knowledge that we measure. And this could be something we would give you a scenario, and you will know what it is, but then you might have to answer something else about the condition. We could tell you something about a patient's signs and symptoms, and then you would have to identify the disease, but then identify perhaps the isolation precautions. So something like this is our more difficult questions for us to write, because we want them to be realistic and applicable to people across the wide span of this profession. Next slide. So as I've said numerous times, each one has to be equivalent to the previous test. Because they're based on the content outline, the annual updates on the computer-based test are going to be somewhat similar. There's always the same percentage of easy and difficult questions. They're always about the same passing score. We try very hard to make it a legitimate test. The AMP specialist will pull potential questions for the new test the next year. However, the test committee can look at a question and say, no, nobody does that anymore. Something else has changed. A standard has changed. practices and no longer something that we do in infection control. So we do have kind of an interesting mix of their expertise with our everyday experiences. Next question. So as we go through each question, we want to make sure also that the stem, which is the actual first part of a question, and that the options are grammatically correct with what we would say in a hospital. Sometimes Vicki, who is our much-loved specialist that traditionally helps us, will say something, and we'll say, no, that's not how people in the hospital would say it. So we try not to use slang, but there are certain things that we would know are correct that we can, again, work together. We want to make sure that it's written clearly so everybody understands. Again, we don't want this to be a tricky question. It's something that if you know it, you should be able to get it right instantly. We want to make sure that the recommendations haven't been changed. Sometimes a new product comes out, things like this that could change the practice. And we're trying to be very sensitive because we know that between Canada and the United States and the rest of the world, there are different things available in different marketplaces. So if it's anything that's really product or usage specific, you won't find it on the exam because we're trying very hard to make this a global test. Next question, next slide. For example, this is something that we could have come up with, and this is something that traditionally people coming to a test committee meeting for the first time. We all write questions. We encourage all of you to submit questions to us because we want the questions to represent what we do as a profession. So sometimes when we're trying to write an analysis question, we tend to think of things like, if I put more words into it, it'll make it look like it's more thought rest needed here. So a patient's been admitted, known drug abuser, on and on, and then the twist would be a PPD has been ordered. And then the right answers would be A, B, C, or D, and you would normally pick one. Well, when we get together for our test committee meetings, we would look at this, next slide, and say, that's silly. It's unnecessary wording. The question will get changed, and it would go to something like, the appropriate administration route of a TST, we're trying to use the new nomenclature, tuberculin skin test, or we may also use PPD/TST, is, and then your options would be subcutaneous, intrathecal, et cetera. It's the same information, but it's presented more. If you know what you're doing, you'll get it right. And Sheila and I laughed when I included this picture in the slides. We would love for you to all believe that we're all young and dynamic and great looking, and we sit around in committees and like on couches and come up with these questions. Basically, we're the same as the rest of the profession, a little older, a little more tired, and very dedicated to the field, though. Next slide. A few more reassurances if you're thinking that, I'm not quite sure if I'm ready for this. Although the exams are based on North American practice, because we sent the practice analysis out primarily to our Canadian, CHICA Canada members, the APIC members, Saudi Arabians, they are being practiced, taken all over the world. So we are trying to very much make a global exam. By doing this, we have gotten rid of all the questions that refer to any of the national organizations, such as OSHA and the Joint Commission. There are certain things in there still referring to CDC guidelines, perhaps. But a lot of this is based on global practice. If it's something that would be done differently in Canada or someplace else by regulations, you won't find it on the exams anymore. We really want the questions to be applicable to the practice of infection prevention and control every place, because we are really a large global community. Next slide. One more time, there are no trick questions. We want to measure your knowledge, not your test-taking skills. It's one of those things that some people don't take tests well, but if it's something you do every day, it's something you shouldn't have any difficulty with. There's no special tricks, and if you ever had the professors that, you know, you knew how their tests worked, if in doubt, if you picked A, they were 95% of the time right. We have, with the computer-based testing, the ability to scramble things. So there is necessarily, you know, not any one answer that you can always pick and have a better advantage of passing it. Trying to get rid of all those negatively worded and all the above except questions. Even with the all capitals in except, I will still miss them if I'm looking at an exam question. And that's generally what the people on the board will miss when we're going through them. So we've tried to get very hard to get rid of them. We have read your comments. If you've taken the SARA or the CBT and you can make comments, we take them very seriously. We look at them, we discuss them in the group, and we know what your complaints have been. And essentially, it's interesting. It's the same complaints many of us have had. Next slide. We've heard you. We know that people are concerned because you're saying, well, I don't work in an acute care setting. Your scenarios don't apply to me. Try and reread the question. Ask what it's really talking about. Tuberculin skin test is not something just done in acute care. This could be done in a school nursing office. This could be done in an EMT practice, etc. Try and put your work situation into the same question, and you may find that it's basically the same thing that you're doing, but it may be frightening if it says something about a trauma unit and you work in an acute long-term care setting. So just try and revise the question in your own mind. Next slide. The exam is designed to measure your knowledge of infection prevention and control principles. When you get that CIC credential, it means that you're marketable throughout the whole world of healthcare. Today you could be working in a correctional facility in the jail as part of the staff there. Tomorrow you could be working in a large metropolitan health center. That CIC that you've got after your name will mean something no matter what setting you go to. That you're very broad, you're experienced, and you're certified. In case you're more afraid of the computer-based part than the exam itself, this is something we were really concerned about a couple years ago. It's something that we're all pretty much more computer savvy now than when we first came out with the CBT exam. But we have put together an online practice exam that you can take. It's 70 questions. Some of them have been retired from the previous exam, so if you are already certified, you may have seen some of these questions before. Some of them are totally new because there's new things on the content outline. So it's just a way to familiarize yourself with the computerized testing process in your own setting. So for $50, you have access to this on your home or work computer for, I believe it's 60 days. I thought I had it in the slide, but obviously I don't. You can get it through the civic.org website, and it just gives you a chance to see what the questions look like. When you get to the test center, you'll get to practice a little bit of this. You don't certainly have to take the practice exam. But if you really have that computer anxiety, it might be worthwhile to look into it. Next slide. This is what you would see on either the practice exam or when you're in the test center. This is how the computer-based questions are. And it's very similar to a lot of the practices we do on a daily basis, looking at different things on our desktops. But you will see on the bottom, you know, where you have things like cover, help, time, there is an apostrophe or an exclamation point there next to time. If you want to make any kind of a comment about the question, you can click on that and leave us a comment. And the AMP people will get back and, you know, get back to us and tell us people have made comments about certain questions. And you just scroll basically with the greater than plus sign, right, left arrows on to the next question. You can go back, forward, sideways, whatever you want while you're taking the exam, in the computer-based test or during the practice. So it's just something to actually play with to build up your confidence. The next slide. Practice exam proportionally matches the content, COG levels, and difficulty of the certification. Now I've got it. It's 60 days from the time of purchase that you can play with it. Go in, go out. But when you hit the final, you know, enter button, that cover, that you finished the exam, you will get an email telling you, you know, yes, you know how you've done it. You can't go back into it. You can't retake it. But you'll be able to review the questions and explanations. What we're doing with our next version of the practice exam is giving you some more references. If you need to learn more about that type of content, that type of question, places where you might be able to study before you take the real exam. Next slide. After completing the practice exam, you get the score by email. It tells you how you did in all the different areas of the content. So you'll be able to know what you really need to study harder and what you're doing really great in. The one thing we do have to tell you, don't assume that if you've done great on the practice exam, it may not automatically mean that you're going to pass the certification exam. But what it's geared to do is tell you what your weak areas are, tell you what to expect from the computer-based test experience. And I think it may boost your confidence if you're worried about computerized testing. Next slide. Sheila had mentioned briefly a little bit about why you have to retake the exam. When you think about it, and I know we're getting short on time, I know we have all taken classes for the CEUs, and we've probably all picked things that we were interested in, but it may be something that your boss tells you what you're going to go to. The seminar format is considered passive learning. And I know, and I'm sure some of you have done it too, if it's something you're not really interested in, if the speaker is boring, you may have to travel someplace, you may not learn as much from it as you had really hoped. You don't know how much you have really gained from the session. There's no testing for most things with CEUs, unless you're doing some of the online type things. But if you attended a class, there's no necessarily passing grade. So there are some good reasons why we do mandate it. And with the CBT becoming more universally available and able to schedule at your own leisure, we're hoping that it really makes a difference for you. Next slide. So are you ready to become certified? And this is going back to those old values that I gave you at the beginning of my presentation. Do you value the best interests of the public and the profession? Are you focused on your customers? Are you responsive to what's going on in all of our worlds? No matter where you're listening in from, we're all dealing with new challenges on a daily basis. So if you can accept the change and support excellence, we'd be happy to have you join us. Sheila's going to take over for now. Sheila?
Okay, thanks, Sharon. And I know that we're running short on time, so just a couple of more things. Preparing for the exam. If you're getting ready and you're thinking, I'm going to do that exam this year, there are a couple of tips. Review the content outline that we spoke about. Look at your references. Look at the references on the website, books, journals, standards, guidelines, and so on, all those things that you use all the time in your job. Some people prefer to form study groups, and that's fine. And Sharon has already mentioned the practice exam that is available for purchase that will help you become more comfortable with the computer-based exam. And just in closing, this is our 25th anniversary for CIBIC this year, and we'd love to add your name to our roster and the certification, CIC, credential. We're working on a new motto, and one of our board members, Deanie Lancaster, came up with this, elevating the profession, elevating the professional, and ultimately we're elevating the quality of infection control, and we're also elevating the quality of healthcare for our patients. So if you're thinking about doing the exam this year, go for it. Thanks very much for listening, everyone.
Thank you very much, Sheila. And Sharon both presented some really very important information and did it very well indeed. Thank you very much for that. We are unable to open the line for question and answer, largely because the audience is so large and so global. But if you have a question for either or both of our speakers, please do email it to me, and I will get an answer from them and get it back to you. In closing, let me thank everyone who has registered to join this teleclass and those who are joining it as a guest of somebody else. Special thanks to Sheila McDonald and Sharon Christofiak for their time to prepare and present this teleclass. Thank you very much to you two. And to all of you who are preparing to take a run at your CIC exam, I offer you my very best wishes. Please do let me know how things turn out for you. I'd like to know that. So until we talk again, everyone, goodbye.